There have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. Lusitania during World War I played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. But the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who obsessed over it, quested to find its remains and to bring them up to the surface, in some cases even claimed to own the wreck. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an interest in shipwrecks? Are you curious about them? Have you seen one up close? Maybe we've got a few different museums around the Great Lakes that show remains of shipwrecks. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your own memories, your questions for our guests. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Could you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it. And once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope from the like amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals, mm-hmm. and all points in between. There's a lot of people who have done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers. And eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. I have my 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like, one was there was a, you know, sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then up all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York. And that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought you would be interested in that, because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several hundred million dollars of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as is to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic. And just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books. And I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee. And from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north, Lake Michigan shore, down to Chicago in the 1800s, so people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees, and it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know, but the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made about the Titanic do especially well in China, and they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you've mentioned, the boat and the ship and the song. And my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was a extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right? Like Columbus or Da Gama. But we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. Scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is of course lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier. and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic, to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daniel Stone, author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic, about mainly the Titanic and the people who looked to find its remains over the years, bring them up. A lot of human stories involved in that.